live from Washington, it's the Inside Scoop, with all the news the government does not want you to know. Now, here's the host of the Inside Scoop, congressional attorney Mark Levine.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. It was just a few months ago that a reporter raised the question of $4 a gallon gasoline to George Bush, and the president seemed genuinely surprised, shocked at the notion that gas prices could ever rise $4 a gallon. Today, that price is not at all unheard of, and the president last week was taken to sputtering, "I don't have a magic wand. I can't do anything. What do you think I am, president?" Well, he didn't quite say that, but he did say there was no magic wand and that basically it was helpless. He couldn't do anything about gas prices. But should anything be done about gas prices? After all, with the demand for gas, that just keeps us going into foreign countries in the Middle East and paying them trillions of dollars and staying in enormous debt. Clearly, America needs to get off its addiction to foreign oil. But that's the long-term solution. What's the short-term solution? Should we change the gas tax, for example? Should there be a windfall profits tax for oil companies? Are they profiting off our misfortune? How about refinery capacity? Is that the solution? And what should be the long-term answer? Jimmy Carter tried to help us in the 70s to get off our addiction to foreign oil, and then came the 80s and nothing happened. These are tough questions, and I don't pretend to have all the answers, but I sure hope my guest does. His name is Tyson Slocum. He is the director of the energy program at Public Citizen, which I should make clear is no longer affiliated with Ralph Nader. But more importantly, he was on this show just 3 years ago when we were complaining about the high gas prices. Then I think we were complaining about $2 a gallon. Now it's $4 a gallon, and he's scheduled to testify tomorrow before the House Transportation Committee. Tyson Slocum, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hey, great to be here.
What are you going to tell the House Transportation Committee tomorrow?
Well, they want to know why prices are spiking so high. And what I'm going to tell them is that the current levels of prices that we're seeing, around $115, $120 a barrel, are not justified by the supply-demand fundamentals. There are no global shortages of crude oil. I'm not talking about a conspiracy here. What it is under-regulation of the futures markets. Contrary to what most people think, the price of oil and gasoline is not set by OPEC. It's not set in Saudi Arabia. They try to influence the price with their decisions about how much to produce and how much to export. But the price is actually set every day in energy trading exchanges in New York. And in the year 2000, Congress deregulated those energy trading exchanges at the request of a single company whose name was Enron Corporation.
I've heard of Enron, and they're the same ones that were playing with the energy markets in California that cost consumers billions of dollars.
Exactly. And so what this all means is with no watchdog on the beat, with no traffic cop there to oversee what's going on every day on these energy markets, we believe that the door is wide open for anti-competitive practices or for collusion or manipulation to occur. We've also seen a huge influx of new players, hedge funds, investment banks that have joined with the oil companies and engaging in very significant amounts of trading volume every day. So we're seeing a lot of funny business in these markets, and we think a lot of it has to do with the fact that it's the Wild West. There's no government oversight over these markets. In fact, the federal government has no idea who the big players are, what positions they're taking. And so that's why my organization, Public Citizen, is going to be talking tomorrow about the need to fully regulate these markets so we have some transparency, because we believe that markets that are transparent are markets that are well-functioning.
Now, you've said a lot of things here. I want to break it down piece by piece. First of all, oil has gone over $100 a barrel for the first time just this year, right?
Correct.
And inflation adjusted, is it still the highest ever?
Correct, yeah.
And your argument is this isn't OPEC, this isn't, because I hear on the news, on CNN and MSNBC, they say it's Chinese demand and Indian demand, and that's raising oil prices. Are they wrong?
Well, no. I mean, we shouldn't see gasoline back at a dollar a gallon. I mean, there are some supply-demand fundamentals that clearly give legitimate cause for pushing prices up. But we believe about at least $30 of the current price of a barrel of crude, which translates to about 70 cents a gallon, is pure speculation that is unrelated to the underlying supply-demand fundamentals.
70 cents
correct.
Of a gallon of gasoline that we pay at the pump is pure speculation.
That's correct.
Well, now, come on, we got a free market, right? Well, maybe we don't. You'll tell me in a minute. But it seems to me that if someone's speculating mm-hmm. that the way it works, it's supposed to work. I learned this in economics. I mean, I graduated with a degree in economics, is if someone is pricing it too high, mm-hmm. then you have another competitor. If ExxonMobil's too high, Texaco comes in, or British Petroleum, and they sell it at 68 cents, and someone sells it at 66 cents under, until you get to the real supply-demand place where the curves cross. Why isn't this free market working?
Well, first, oil is much different. There are no bilateral contracts. It's all there's a single clearing price for crude oil.
You say who sets that? It's the speculators?
The speculators are setting it. And so that's part of the problem.
And one's going to bet that it's lower than you think it should be.
Right. Every once in a while, there are some bets that take it a little lower. But right now, there's more room to go up than there is to go down. And so if you're a speculator, betting up gives you a much higher ceiling and gives you more room to play with and therefore more money to make.
But isn't there a spot market? I mean, if I want to sell wheat, and I know there's a food crisis mm-hmm. too, we won't go there.
Right.
But if I want to sell wheat on the open market, there are so many buyers and so many sellers. There's the futures exchange in Chicago, and they
correct.
Raise, I'll sell so many pork barrels for so much, and that regulates the price. You're telling me oil isn't done the same way?
Almost 99% of every contract that determines the price of oil does not result in the physical delivery of crude oil, which means the vast majority, almost all the trades that are going on, are nothing but paper trades between middlemen that are trying to get an edge to push the price
but
up.
Isn't that true for wheat markets at the Commodities Future Exchange in Chicago and frankly, for the stock market in New York?
There's a couple things that are different. One, the volume that we're dealing with energy commodities is far higher than what we see in agricultural commodities. Second, the agricultural commodities are in fully regulated exchanges that are completely regulated by the U.S. Commodity Exchange Act.
So what's the difference? What does the U.S. Commodity Exchange Act do with regard to wheat prices that it doesn't do with regard to oil prices?
The Commodity Exchange Act requires major players to identify themselves. They have to report basic details of their activities. Who they're trading with, at what prices, what volumes, and this isn't, Big Brother intervening.
That's not required in the oil industry? We don't know who these contracts are?
Not in the unregulated markets. Now, you've got NYMEX, the New York Mercantile Exchange. There you've got all the guys in the starched white shirts screaming at each other in
right,
the pit.
Right.
But most of the trades, about 70% of the daily volume, is now being undertaken on these new electronic exchanges. These are the exchanges that Enron pioneered in the 1990s, and it's why Enron pushed for this deregulation legislation, because they did not want to have government looking over their shoulder, because Enron, as we all know, was a bankrupt company, a bankrupt business model, where their only intent was to enter markets to manipulate them.
Now, you're saying that in the 1990s, it was mostly on a regulated exchange, the NYMEX, for example, that most oil contracts were like stocks and agriculture back in the 1990s.
That's correct. Almost all the trades were done on NYMEX. You could exit it if you were just doing a one-on-one contract, say if I'm UPS or FedEx, I realize that I'm going to be a little short on my oil deliveries for my plane fleet to move packages, I could give a call to ExxonMobil and do an exchange of a futures exchange, basically, without having to go through NYMEX. And that still goes on.
This is fascinating to me. This is a real inside scoop, because
right.
you have George Bush saying, I can't do anything. I have no magic wand. Go away. Don't ask me anymore. You have John McCain and Hillary Clinton saying, well, let's lower the gas tax a few
right.
cents, and that's the solution. Obama saying that's not the solution. Maybe we need more money, more oil from the reserve that we have,
right.
the strategic reserve. No one's saying what you're saying except you. Why not?
Well, I mean, we have been working to get legislation to re-regulate these markets. Right now, we've got an amendment in the stalled farm bill that would do it just for natural gas, because natural gas plays a very big role in the agricultural economy, because natural gas is a big feedstock for fertilizer. We haven't been successful so far in getting amendments attached to legislation that would address re-regulation of crude oil and other petroleum products.
Is there a hero in Congress that believes in what you're saying and pushing that the viewers could call up and say, go forward, and they can call their local congressman and say,
absolutely. There's legislation spearheaded by Senator Dianne Feinstein from California. She's been working on this since 2001 and 2002.
So viewers could say to Senator Warner or Senator Webb, hey,
right,
go support Feinstein's legislation.
Exactly. So there is legislation that is great that would re-regulate these. And so that's one important piece here, is establishing some sanity to these markets, reintroducing transparency, and we believe that that would lower the prices a little bit. Now, this is not going to bring prices down to $1.50 a gallon. People are still going to be experiencing pain, but they're not going to feel like they're getting price gouged by oil companies and hedge funds.
Who are the 70%? Who are they that are not on the NYMEX, not on the regulated exchange? Who are these people?
Well, Goldman Sachs, the Wall Street investment firm, is the largest commodities trader in the world. They have a subsidiary called J. Aron that is the world's largest trader of crude oil and other energy products. Morgan Stanley, another big Wall Street bank.
Banks and Wall Street firms? They're
absolutely
the ones that are doing oil deals?
Absolutely. And
what
funds
about Exxon and Texaco and
Exxon
Saudi
is,
Arabia?
Exxon is not really a big trader. The two oil companies that have a big presence in the futures markets are two European companies, BP and Shell.
British Petroleum.
Right. And Marathon, to a certain extent, that's an American company, and they have an energy trading subsidiary as well.
So when ExxonMobil buys oil from Saudi Arabia, they just go at the spot market price, they're happy with it, they take it.
Right, but
they
also
don't really affect the price much.
But also remember, you know, ExxonMobil is a giant producer of oil. I mean, ExxonMobil produces more oil itself every day than the entire Kingdom of Kuwait. Exxon has
so they don't buy it from anyone. In other words,
they are buying some oil, but
they
remember,
give royalties to these countries. But they own the oil.
Well, it depends what the country is. You know, there are some countries they're operating in where they do not have ownership rights over the oil. They just get a cut of the proceeds of what they extract. But ExxonMobil is a massive producer within the United States. You know, most people forget that America produces 8 million barrels of oil every day. That makes us the third biggest oil producer on the planet.
After only Saudi Arabia and Iran?
Russia. Russia is the second largest
after
producer.
Saudi Arabia.
Right.
But they mostly produce it in-house. We're not buying oil from Russia.
A little
we?
Bit.
We are buying oil.
You know, here in the D.C. metro area, you see a couple of Lukoil stations, which is a Russian oil company. We get a little bit of oil. Russia supplies mostly is Europe and China.
I'll tell you, there are so many complexities to this issue.
And
when we come back after break, I want to ask you what I seem to recall you said 3 years ago, which was that it was refinery capacity that was causing a huge problem. And if I remember correctly, and it has been 3 years, you said that the oil companies were purposely not having enough refinery capacity, mm-hmm. so that was a bottleneck, and that was the cause of high prices.
Right.
I kind of thought that's what you were going to say today, but you threw me for a loop with this regulated markets. So I want to know about that, and I want to talk about gas taxes. And I also want to hear from our listeners and see what do you think is causing the problem, and perhaps more importantly, what do you think the solution should be? What should we do about high gas prices? I want to welcome everyone listening for the first time. We've got video right on the web. This is the first show to do that, to have live video broadcast. And we're glad to have you watching us as well as listening to us, as well as, of course, watching us on local TV. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop and your phone.
How far would you go to help someone? Would you go to the end of your driveway? Would you cross a street? Would you cross an ocean? To a place 6,000 miles from home? And how long would you go? Would you go for a week? A month? A year? Would you go for 2 years? Would you go if you could use your knowledge to teach someone? And in the process, maybe learn something yourself. Life is calling. How far will you go? Peace Corps.
James, don't forget your helmet.
Will do.
Not a helmet.
your bike helmet.
Oh, okay.
Hi, I'm James Thrash with the Washington Redskins. On the football field, a helmet is an important piece of equipment. I also wear another helmet that's just as important. A bike helmet. It's the most important piece of equipment you'll have the next time you're out on your bike. Wear yours and make sure your kids do too. Safety first with the Skins.
Monica and her friends want you to know that you should never get near a dog when it is eating, playing with a favorite toy, or sleeping. It's really important to make time for exercise and games and keep your dog's vaccines up to date. Never leave a dog in a small, confined space. This can make dogs aggressive like Monica. If you follow this advice, you and your dog can play safely and happily together.
We are back to the Inside Scoop. Call in live and let your voice be heard. Here again, your host, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Have you noticed that gasoline is a bit higher at the pump? Okay, more than a bit. If you haven't noticed, well, you don't drive. Because all across the country, oil prices, gasoline prices are the highest ever, even when adjusting for inflation. What is causing these high gas prices? Why does it seem to happen every summer? What can be done about them? And maybe nothing should be done at all. After all, we have to wean America off of foreign oil. Maybe when George Bush says, I don't have a magic wand, I can't do anything, maybe he's right. What do you think? 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. My guest is the director of the energy program at Public Citizen, Tyson Slocum. Tyson, before we get to what should be done, let's just make clear on what the problem is. Uh-huh. Now, you tell me it's because markets aren't regulated, but hey, 3 years ago, you told me it was refinery capacity. Which is it? Both?
Well, yeah, there's a number of factors, and definitely refining capacity is a big issue because we're awash in excess supply of crude oil. But crude oil is pretty useless unless you can refine it into something like gasoline or jet fuel. And the problem is that we've allowed so many mergers over the last couple of years. And remember, Exxon and Mobil, until recently, were two of the biggest competitors in the United States. They're now the same company. Same thing with Chevron and Texaco. They're now the same company. ConocoPhillips. The list goes on and on. And what they did was they were allowed to merge all of their refining operations. So we've got a high degree of market concentration, which means a couple of players own a big chunk of the market. And what that means is not a whole lot of competition.
So now, traditionally, refineries, they're very expensive, I guess, to
Correct.
Build. They're very large, and most people don't want them in their neighborhoods because Right. there's a stench and a smell to them. But when these companies combine, then they don't have competition, I guess they like the bottleneck in the refinery.
Exactly. I mean, refining profit margins in the 1990s were very weak. A lot of refineries were losing money. But remember that a lot of the big companies that own all these oil refineries are vertically integrated companies.
What does that mean?
That means like an ExxonMobil. Not only does Exxon drill and extract crude oil out of the ground, not only do they then send that oil on their own network of pipelines and oil tankers, but they also own and control the oil refineries where that crude oil is turned into gasoline. And then they even have distribution outlets where they've got branded gas stations on your street corner. So that is what I mean by vertical integration. And at every stage, they are making record profits. And the CEO of ExxonMobil, Rex Tillerson, recently told the Wall Street Journal that the company would never build a new refinery in the United States, not because it's too difficult, not because of environmental laws, but because there's not enough money in it. Because if you build a new refinery at a cost of billions of dollars over 5 or 10 years that it takes to build a large industrial facility like that, they're not going to be able to recoup their investment because ExxonMobil predicts that gasoline demand is going to peak by the year 2020. And once gasoline demand peaks, the investment and the return on the investment for that refinery is going to go down. Now contrast that with the present situation where you've got too little refining capacity, and we all know in supply and demand, when you have too little of something, it becomes extremely valuable. And that's why the refiners are making so much money. Now, they've tapered off a little bit compared to a year or two ago, but it's still a very healthy business. And that's one of the issues that I'll be talking to Congress about tomorrow, is an investigation into how much of anti-competitive practices within the refining industry is leading to higher prices at the pump.
Do you agree with CEO Rex Tillerson? Do you think we're going to hit a demand peak of gasoline in 2020 and then it'll go down? Again, everyone seems to be saying China and India will keep demanding it. Is he right, or is he just saying that as an excuse in order to keep that bottleneck and keep prices high?
I think he probably is right. I would like to see the demand peak a little earlier, and we could do that.
With hybrid cars and things like
that. Exactly, and that's what we need to do. We are not being aggressive enough on pushing for giving Americans access to alternatives to these high prices. You know, I hear a lot of politicians almost blame motorists. Motorists keep driving, you know. Well, that's because we don't have a choice. Most people have to drive in America to take their kids to school, to get to work.
Not enough public transportation.
We don't have enough public transit. We don't have enough automobiles that run super fuel efficiently. And a lot of people can't afford to buy a hybrid car. They'd love to go to the dealer and spend a couple $1,000s extra, but they can't afford it.
Let me go to the phone lines. We have Jeffrey from Woodbridge. Jeffrey, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
You look a little funny on the tape delay through the Internet. But the simple fact is we have a president who is Texas oil man, a vice president who is the largest oil services firm in the country, and we're having the same issues California did with the energy prices. There's no quote-unquote shortage, they're saying. It's just supply and demand. Wasn't Enron going to be indicted for doing just this 5 years ago in California? Oh, under the same president?
Well, let me ask our guest this. Thank you for your call, Jeffrey. How much of this is planned? Okay, we got the companies. They're trying to make profits. As our caller suggests, the president likes that. He's an oil man. The vice president likes that. He's an oil man. Are they really sitting there saying, how can we increase oil profits for our friends? Is that fair? Is that true?
I don't know if it's as crass as that, but there's no question that we've seen on a multitude of issues with the president and the vice president that they view a lot of issues within a very small box of their reality. And there's no question that from the very beginning of the Bush administration, when he asked Vice President Dick Cheney to run his energy task force, Dick Cheney only consulted with energy company CEOs and their lobbyists. So,
and then he made it secret so we couldn't find that out for
right,
many years.
Exactly. And so it shouldn't have come to it as a surprise that Bush's energy policy is reflective of what energy companies want. And what energy companies want is to make as much money as possible.
Let me ask you this. There will always be businesses that want monopoly profits. Again, anyone who studies economics knows how it works. When you control the supply, you can artificially increase prices. In fact, the thing that made us so scared of Arab oils was way back in 73, 74 when OPEC did an embargo. And what they did is they cut back on supply in order to set the price. That's when the crude oil producers were using a bottleneck in order to set the price. In the United States, in order to prevent monopolies from setting prices, and monopolies always have the power to do that, we have, in fact, I think we're the first country in the world to have an antitrust act. The Sherman Antitrust Act dates back to the 1880s, one of the best pieces of law I think America has ever put forth. The Sherman Antitrust Act takes these big corporations and says, no, we believe in the free market. We believe in competition. Yet you've described this vertical integration of Exxon where they control everything from getting it out of the ground all the way up to getting it to the consumer. Are these violations of the Sherman Antitrust Act? And if so, who can stop them? Only the government, or perhaps can the consumer sue?
Well, unfortunately, Congress has weakened the Sherman Antitrust Act over the last decades. And the Supreme Court has repeatedly sided against consumers and in favor of industry in their interpretations of it. So the combination of congressional intervention to weaken the act and courts interpreting it in a weaker way.
And the third branch, executive government, isn't bringing lawsuits.
Exactly.
Sure. So all three branches, I guess.
And so that's been a big problem, is that the Sherman Antitrust Act is a shadow of its former self.
It was such a great law, too.
Absolutely. Teddy Roosevelt used it
to break up Standard Oil companies. That's right.
And right now,
the trust buster, in fact.
Standard Oil would be looking in envy at the oil companies of today. I mean, we all hear about their profits, right? ExxonMobil, $40 billion last year.
What does that mean? That's hard. $40 billion, I can't even...
Well, I'll let you know how much it is. Not only did they make $40 billion in profit, but last year they spent almost $32 billion buying back their stock. That's how much money ExxonMobil has, that the amount of money that they're spending...
They have no place to put it.
...buying back stock is bigger than most federal government programs.
Now, is it correct that ExxonMobil made more money than any other corporation on Earth, and that the amount of money they made is more than any corporation has ever made in human history. Is that right?
Correct. They are the largest corporation in the history of
humanity.
Yes. And it's a well-run company in terms of what they give to their shareholders. But the problem is, what bang are we getting for our buck? We're out there pumping gas, not because we're gluttons for punishment, but because we need to drive to get to where we need to go. And the higher prices we're paying are not being reinvested into things that are going to help ease this pain for us. It's not going to end our oil addiction. Rather, ExxonMobil is taking the money that we're pumping into our tanks and doing it to, you know, spending it on stock buybacks
and executive compensation. Now, are they paying taxes? Are they being a good corporate citizen? At least we're getting some money back into our treasury? Or are they avoiding taxation, too?
Well, I mean, they are paying taxes, but Public Citizen estimates that the oil industry enjoys about $9 billion a year, courtesy of the American taxpayer, in subsidies.
And $9 billion
a year. $9 billion.
In other words, another corporation not making that same amount of money, there is none, but if another corporation were to make that same amount of money, they would pay $9 billion more in taxes.
That's
correct. Exxon, because it's an oil company, gets corporate welfare?
That's correct. They get a multitude of tax breaks. There are entire Department of Energy spending programs. And to top it off, recent law changes allow some of these big oil companies to evade paying the American taxpayer royalties for the privilege of extracting oil and gas off of land owned by the American people.
They can go to national parks. They can go
not to national parks, but to like offshore, like the Gulf of Mexico.
So they can drill on federal land in the water that, hey, Exxon doesn't own the water.
Right.
The United States of America owns the water. They can go out into our waters, drill, and not pay us for it?
Because we allowed them to. We changed
laws. Is that the energy bill that we heard so much about a few years ago? Are they the ones that give them?
It's partly that. There was in 2005, which, remember, the 2005 energy bill, which was the most expensive energy bill in American history, had its foundation in Vice President Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force report. Nearly all of the recommendations that Vice President Dick Cheney put together with the, of course, secret input of all the oil executives, got adopted into law. And what that was $5 billion in new subsidies to big oil. And in addition, there were some bureaucratic oversights that allowed some oil companies to start extracting oil without paying taxpayers for the privilege.
Just a few seconds left before the break, but that was in the Republican Congress in 2005. Is there any hope that the Democratic Congress can overturn that?
Absolutely. The House voted in February to repeal $18 billion in subsidies, but it stalled in the Senate because President Bush has threatened to veto it.
So we're going to have a new president to do that. Folks, if you want to call in and join the discussion, please do. 888-488-MARK. Back after this.
Serves a sentence with you.
I'm Bob Costas, and I've been broadcasting sports for a long time. Much of what I do is ad-libbed, but still, one of the most important aspects of my job is being able to write. Narrations, essays, commentaries. It's essential to express those thoughts and concepts clearly and concisely. Good writing is essential for almost any career. And with today's advanced technology, the National Commission on Writing reports that the need to write well has never been more important. Writing is everybody's business.
Sure, my neighbors Gene and Louise, they may be superheroes with superpowers, but that doesn't make them so super at saving energy and money.
Honey!
I may not be able to harness the power of the elements, but I save significant cash and help the environment with appliances, electronics, and windows featuring the Energy Star label. So discover your own energy-saving superpowers. Go to ase.org/consumers.
Mom, Dad
Dad's making fondue again.
We are back to the Inside Scoop. Call in live and let your voice be heard. Here again, your host, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Why are gasoline prices so high? Why are oil prices so high? What can be done about it? What should be done about it? My guest is Tyson Slocum. He's the director of the energy program at Public Citizen. He's going to testify tomorrow before the House Transportation Committee on this very subject. We've got some caller on the line, Leo from Fairfax. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you very much. A question, if I may.
Please.
Price of gasoline today in Europe, $8 a gallon. Why is that?
Taxes.
$8 a gallon.
Okay, taxes.
Okay, right.
Good. If you want somebody to use less of something, is it not the use of the tax code that we traditionally use to tax something to get people to use less of it? Why in the world are we doing that?
So, Leo, you would support higher gasoline taxes, not lower gasoline taxes.
It would seem to me, if you want to, as Al Gore advocates, eventually disengage ourselves from the internal combustion engine altogether, then $4, $8, maybe $15 a gallon is the only way to drive a true American capitalist in another direction.
I'll tell you what, Leo, I actually agree with you, but I'm going to ask you a tough question before I get to Tyson Slocum, because it's the question that every politician gets when this is suggested to them. What about all the poor people that are struggling to get by? We've got a terrible economy. We've got a mortgage crisis, and they need to get to work or to hold their jobs. What? And we don't have enough public transportation today. We should have it for the future. What do you do about that if you increase the gas taxes?
What it did for promoting the airline industry was place an FAA budget at $35 billion a year so that we could fly people from New York to California on the cheap. Why wouldn't you pump $35 billion a year into ground transportation so people could get to work?
So you would take the money from the gas tax and put it into public transportation?
I would.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. I appreciate that, Leo. I'm going to take his suggestion and throw it to you, Tyson. How about that? Higher, not lower. Sorry, Clinton. Sorry, McCain. Lower gas taxes. Higher gas taxes and put that into public transportation.
Well, first, we've already seen prices nearly triple over the last 5 years, and yet it hasn't had a significant impact on demand. And that's because people, as you said, have to keep driving. And so while I agree with the sentiment of the caller, I think what I would rather see first is massive investment before you enact higher taxes.
So you take the $35 million or whatever he was talking about. First, you build the public transportation.
Right.
That could take 4 or 5 years.
Right.
And then you increase taxes, I guess, retroactively to
exactly.
pay for what you've just done.
Exactly. Or you put additional income taxes on oil company profits and on hedge funds.
Well, now, what
like
about
that?
Because there was a windfall profits tax way back in the 70s, I think, under Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan ran against that, said it was terrible that you right. would charge these capitalist countries. Companies. And then Hillary Clinton proposes a reduction in the gas tax combined with a windfall profits tax.
Right.
Obama responds and says, first of all, that's just a gimmick. That just, if you reduce the gas tax, that just means more money goes to the corporations. And since you won't get a windfall profits tax through this Congress under this president, really, you're just lowering the gas tax. Whose side are you on, or you got a third side?
Well, I think that candidate Obama has a good point. I think that repealing the gas tax, right now the gas tax is 18.4 cents a gallon.
It's not that much.
It was 18.4 cents a gallon when a gallon of gas costs about $1.20. So it has an increase since the early 90s.
And I guess it's actually less. It was 1/6 of the cost of a gallon of gas back then.
Right, and right now it's about 5%
yeah,
or less.
So it's actually less.
Right, and it funds important programs as part of the Highway Trust Fund. So and there's no guarantee that if you repeal it, that prices are going to go down by 18.4 cents a gallon.
Where does the money go if we repeal the gas tax?
The money goes to the Highway Trust Fund that finances all of our roads, bridges,
okay.
and mass
well,
transit.
Okay, well, I guess what I'm saying is if gas prices are $3.98 and then they go down to $3.80, well, there's no more gas tax anymore.
Right.
Will they even go down to $3.80?
No, I don't think that they would go down by
18 cents.
I think they might go down a couple of pennies, but it's not going to be long-standing. Right.
You think that only, so of the 18 cents, if we repeal it, you think they may go down 2 cents, and the other 16 cents goes into the pocket of ExxonMobil?
Right, and some of the retailers and distributors, absolutely. So I do think it's a misguided idea. But again, I disagree with the caller's point. I don't think we should increase the gas tax significantly, or else it just acts as a punitive measure. You first have to provide people with access to alternatives before applying higher market prices on them to change their behavior.
Okay, but why not work in reverse? You told me that you felt, because of speculation, that the price of crude oil was $20 or so higher, and the price of gasoline, you said, at the beginning of this broadcast, was 70 cents higher a gallon than it should be.
Right.
If we were to tax 70 cents, couldn't we take that 70 cents that's a windfall earned by the oil company and give that to the government where it could put it into public transportation?
That's one thing we could do, because definitely there are massive infrastructure needs that we have to finance. Because the oil
industry
is
clearly not doing it. There's a bridge that just fell in a river in Minnesota.
Right, absolutely. And mass transit. We've got to fully invest in mass transit, so we have to give bigger federal grants to local communities. And we have to give bigger financial incentives to American families. Because right now, a lot of folks would love to buy a hybrid car. They can't afford it.
Well, what do they need? A tax break? Is that what it takes?
A tax break.
If you buy a hybrid car, you get $10,000 credit on your
exactly.
tax return.
Exactly. Something like that. And also,
so that a hybrid becomes actually cheaper than a gasoline-burning car.
Exactly. And especially moving towards plug-in hybrids, where you can plug in the car into your outlet and charge the batteries. And that combination of an electric motor and batteries with the internal combustion engine, with existing technology today, in the same kinds of cars that we're driving around now, we'll get about 100 miles to the gallon.
But Tyson, that requires a whole huge infrastructure. I mean, every street corner in every city, every town, every village in America, there's a gas station. And they don't have those plugs. They don't have that stuff for fuel.
But
do we have to put them in every single gas station? What kind of cost
are we
talking
about? Well, no, we have plugs in people's garages. We
can. Is that enough? How long do they last?
Right now, the charge would be very good. And so for hours.
I mean, if I want to travel across country, can I plug in my car at home and make it to some other place with a plug? If I want to travel to Florida, say?
By fully charging the batteries, by plugging it in, what you're doing is allowing your car to run almost exclusively on the electric motor. Once you get off of that and you're just driving, there are things with hybrid technology, like you see in the Prius, where when you apply the brakes, it recaptures the energy of the braking and helps recharge the battery. While you're driving, it's recharging the system.
But a hybrid, by the definition of the word hybrid, I assume means it can run on gasoline.
So in other words, and they do.
If I'm stuck out in the desert and there's not an electric plug anywhere around, my car doesn't break down. I can go back to the old-fashioned technology.
Exactly.
That's what hybrid means.
Exactly. And that's far superior to our misadventure with ethanol, which is something that public citizens strongly opposed. In the 2005 energy bill, there was a massive mandate that was forced upon us to use more ethanol, and it's been a disaster. Corn prices have tripled because almost all the ethanol we produce is from corn. So that's enriched a couple of big agribusiness, but it hasn't helped out.
Grant you ethanol is a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Corn hasn't worked, but
right.
sugarcane has. You look at Brazil,
right.
and how much of their fleet, 10 years ago, none of their fleet ran on sugarcane. Now I'm pretty sure it's the majority of their fleet
runs
on sugarcane. That's amazing. Why is sugarcane just better than corn at doing this?
It is. It's far more efficient.
What should we be using? Switchgrass or?
Switchgrass, we're still in development. Switchgrass doesn't take a whole lot of water or fertilizer, which is important because you have to look at the whole life cycle of whatever plant you're using. But I still do think that it's folly to tie our fuel needs with agriculture.
Even sugarcane or something like it.
Correct. It's sugarcane.
How come Brazil can do it? Just because they can grow sugarcane more easily?
There's that. I mean, there's a lot of it is a lot of Brazil is tropical. Also, there's far fewer cars per person in Brazil than we have, and people drive much less.
So you don't think soybeans are the answer? You don't think really any food stuff is the answer?
I think moving fuel away from agriculture is the best thing for us to do. And instead, I think an electric plug-in hybrid car that runs on a combination gasoline-powered internal combustion engine with electricity is makes the most sense.
But,
and we have the technology.
Okay, but electricity takes a lot of energy, too. I mean, there are coal plants. There's one right here in Alexandria, Virginia. The Moran plant burns. It pollutes the area.
Right.
They're destroying hilltops in West Virginia for coal. We
right.
don't have enough wind or solar energy. Aren't we just moving the problem from one thing to the other? Okay, we won't use oil, but we use coal, different
right.
fossil fuel. That electricity, that doesn't solve our overall problem, does it?
Well, you're hitting on the fact that there's no easy solutions here. But
yeah, I get to ask the questions.
Exactly.
You have to give the answers.
But long-term investments in solar, we are extremely underutilizing our solar capacity. And what Public Citizen has been urging is instead of putting billions of dollars into the pockets of coal and oil companies and subsidies every year, why not instead give subsidies to American families to help them afford to install solar panels on their roof or on their buildings?
Do you think that you can get enough energy, electricity, to, you know, for an electric car, for a house, for
Absolutely.
Hot water and everything,
Absolutely.
Just from solar energy in a typical Absolutely. American home?
Absolutely. You
How
can.
About in the Northeast where there's a lot of cloud cover?
The sun's rays are still getting through even on a cloudy day.
And we have the technology right now
Absolutely.
For American homes.
Absolutely.
It's just too expensive.
Right. But instead, we are focusing on building, you know, new nuclear power plants that will be almost fully subsidized by the American taxpayer. Each new reactor, like the one that Dominion is trying to build in North Anna, Virginia, or the one that Constellation is teaming up with the French government to build in Maryland, those are going to cost at least $10 billion apiece. And those companies do not have the capital to provide all of that. So
That's
the American
taxpayer
is going to provide loan guarantees.
We have another caller on the line, George in Fairfax. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Well, thank you. I just want to go back and revisit the car business that he was talking about earlier as far as fuel. They had CNG, compressed natural gas, what you use to cook in your house. That was widely available. The supplies have dwindled, and it's been a concerted effort to make it harder and harder to get. That was very little pollution from that. There was also a little different design for engines with a spherical valve, which produced less pollution without a catalyst than cars running today do with a catalyst. What did the big three do to it? They did the same thing they did to Tucker. But more importantly, with the energy problem, you have not touched geothermal. In the diamond mines and stuff like that in Africa, they have to pump air conditioning down there because it's so hot down there. This is available in every county of every state in the country. And you're talking about ethanol and switchgrass? What the hell are you talking about?
Okay.
It's available right here.
Well, I'll tell you, you raise a lot of good points, George. I'm going to ask Tyson every one of them. We may have to go and ask some of them over break because George raises so many
sure.
good points. Let me start with his question about cooking fuel, the specific
well,
one.
Well, it was compressed natural gas, I
right.
believe, that he was talking
right.
about. Well, the problem there is that natural gas, we've run into problems with supply of natural gas. We've been using...
We have lots of pipes all over the country. I mean, I heat my home with gas.
Right, absolutely, and that's the problem, is that more and more people are using it not only in their homes and for transportation, but also in power plants. And so that's why we are now talking about importing it. And so natural
gas... Is it that we don't have enough natural gas or we don't have enough pipes or both?
We don't have enough natural gas to meet expected demand.
Where does
demand.
Natural gas come from? What is it, gas underground?
Right. It's usually found near where oil comes from, and so it's a you know.
So it's like a fossil fuel.
It is a fossil fuel.
It just happens
fuel.
To be a gas rather than a liquid.
Right. Exactly.
And so people pump it out of the ground and into pipes, and we just don't have enough, just like we don't have enough oil.
Right. I mean, natural gas prices have been ballooning as well, and so you've got problems of very high natural gas prices. Now, there's a lot of, municipal buses and things like that that run on compressed natural gas that are great, but I don't think that replacing the gasoline in our tanks with natural gas is going to be feasible.
I'll tell you what, George raised a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm.
We will get to all of his questions. I always want to satisfy my listeners. We will answer all of your questions after the break, George. If you want to call in and ask your own questions, don't hesitate to do so. You're never going to have an expert like this again at your beck and call. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Back after this.
One day, I forgot to throw away my trash after lunch, but then I saw it later when I was playing in the woods. The next week, I went boating with my grandpa, and there it was. I tried to go swimming, but I couldn't because of my trash. And when I went fishing, well, you can guess what I caught that day. So now I always throw in my trash in the garbage can, where it belongs.
One in eight Americans goes hungry. One idea helped change that. A community started a garden that blossomed into farmers markets. One in six children lives in poverty. One group of women found an answer by opening a daycare center that their neighbors could afford. Today, 36 million Americans live in poverty. But one by one, people are helping themselves and each other to change the picture of poverty to one of hope. For easy ways you can help, visit PovertyUSA.org.
Every year, 250,000 Americans are diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease.
My fellow scientists and I are working on treatments and a cure for this deadly disease.
Millions of lives are at stake. Alzheimer's disease affects one in three families.
We're committed to uncovering the mystery of Alzheimer's.
And we're not going to quit until the job is done.
To find out more about Alzheimer's disease, call 1-800-437-2423.
Only through research will a cure be found.
Jay, don't forget your helmet.
Will do.
Not your helmet. Your bike helmet.
Oh, okay.
Hi, I'm James Thrash with the Washington Redskins. On the football field, a helmet is an important piece of equipment. I also wear another helmet that's just as important. A bike helmet. It's the most important piece of equipment you'll have the next time you're out on your bike. Wear yours and make sure your kids do too. Safety first with the Skins.
We are back to the Inside Scoop. Call in live and let your voice be heard. Here again, your host, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm talking with Tyson Slocum. He's the director of the Energy Program at Public Citizen. He's going to be testifying before Congress tomorrow on why gasoline and oil prices are so high and what we can do about it, both short-term and long-term. Before the break, one of our callers, George from Fairfax, had a whole slew of questions for you. We didn't get to all of them. I want to get to some of them now. You mentioned what he said about compressed natural gas. Now, George felt very strongly that, like the Enron hedge fund control of prices, that CNG, compressed natural gas, was also because of the big three automakers and so forth were making sure that that price went up. Do you agree with George on that?
Well, I mean, there was widespread manipulation of natural gas prices, and there continues to be.
Just like Enron electricity
because,
else.
Natural gas is a commodity that has been unregulated in the trading
just
activities.
Just like oil.
Exactly.
That you mentioned.
But there are some physical limitations with natural gas. We cannot produce enough of it to meet the expected demand, especially if you're going to have 150 million cars on the American roads running on natural gas.
150 million American cars running on, I haven't seen a natural gas car.
Well, there are CNG, some of the municipal cars for D.C. government.
I guess I have seen them.
Some of the parking meter
those
police.
Little cars.
Exactly. They'll have a little CNG symbol. And so on a limited basis, I think that natural gas works great. But extending it to more and more cars, we just do not have the capacity for it. And again, natural gas is a finite fossil fuel. We need to move away from finite fossil fuels and move towards renewable fuels.
Well, let me ask you about a renewable fuel that George specifically mentioned, and that's geothermal. That, I assume, is the heat from the earth, the natural heat. In the center of the earth's core, there's a big fire. That's an understatement that could warm us all until the earth, as long as the earth exists, which is a pretty long time. Is maybe that's the answer.
Well, in areas of the country where geothermal pockets are not too deep and
Hawaii could be all needed
and
there, by
there are some on the West Coast. I mean, there are many geothermal power plant facilities that are extremely successful in the United States. But geothermal is not widely available in every county of the United States. There's only certain areas where
near volcanoes, is that where it tends to be?
Right, or near areas where you've got seepage, you've got fault lines and things like that. Again,
so the West Coast, Hawaii.
We could spend billions and billions drilling extremely deep holes, or we could just give people a $10,000 rebate for them to install solar panels on their roof.
So you think solar is the better
solar
solution?
Solar is a no-brainer.
But in some areas of the country, geothermal could be better than solar.
Absolutely, but it has limited range. Again, we need to make sure that we're using all of the accessible geothermal that we are because it is a great energy source, but we believe that solar power is absolutely, hands down, the best energy source of the future, and we've got huge undercapacity. Every building in the United States should have solar panels on the roof. But we don't have that.
What about wind power? We haven't talked much about that. I know there's a proposal to have these huge turbines offshore, these large windmills, actually, but very fancy, good windmills. Is that an answer?
Yeah. I mean, it's not going to solve all of our needs, but wind is a very, very good renewable energy source. We have to make sure that we do adequate environmental impact statements so that we don't locate these giant windmill turbines in migratory bird pathways or things like that.
Sure.
But it's unfortunate that some of these high-profile offshore wind proposals have been knocked down by wealthy property owners. Like there's one outside of Nantucket in Cape Cod in Massachusetts.
And I saw what pictures, or at least artist rendering, of what it would look like, and it was a couple dots, like miles away.
Right.
You hardly noticed
it. And if anyone has actually seen a wind farm up close, they're majestic. And it is phenomenal.
Well, I like them in Holland, certainly.
Absolutely.
Why not?
So wind has to be part of the mix. Solar has to be part of the mix. Investments in energy efficiency. That's not only for our homes, but also for our automobiles. We have to achieve better fuel efficiency and better energy efficiency in our homes so we use less energy.
Now, are we doing all the hydroelectric we can do? There are a lot of dams across America. Is that pretty much, we've done pretty much all we can do with hydroelectric?
Well, you could do more, but again, you've got environmental impacts from damming rivers. You've got silt that backs up. You've got problems of fish in the water and what happens downstream and what happens upstream.
So solar is still, hands down,
absolutely,
in your mind, the
and
very best.
And there's been huge advancements in solar technology since the 1970s, and it's really come a long way.
Now, George from Fairfax has called back, and he has a problem with some of the things that you've been saying. I've got to give my listener a chance.
Of course.
Go ahead, George. What's your problem with what Tyson's been talking about?
Well, I'm not sure where you got your guess from.
He's from Public Citizen, which is a consumer organization.
Well, I tell you what, he's like Fox, the channel Fox TV.
You're a spy, Tyson.
He's spreading disinformation.
Well, tell me what's disinformation.
What he's doing is not misleading. He's lying to the public.
What am I lying about? If you can give an example.
Be specific, George.
I mean, you're accusing me of a liar.
There's so much CNG, they don't know what to do with it. Geothermal is available anywhere. What he has said is that it's available in certain specific areas, like Iceland, they have an easy access to. Yes, it just means you have to go a little deeper.
Which is very expensive. And that's the cost-benefit analysis I'm telling you about. That I'm not saying geothermal is impossible, but it is extremely expensive to dig extremely deep holes deep in the earth, and it's much cheaper to install solar panels. I'm saying, do a cost-benefit analysis. In those areas of the United States where geothermal is cost-effective, absolutely let's use it, and we should use it. But in places, not every part of the United States is geothermal inexpensive. It can cost absurd amounts of money to dig extremely deep holes into the earth.
What you're promoting is something like nuclear. And
no, but he's promoting solar too, George.
Construction companies, if you remember Root & Brown, that's Cheney's buddy. Cheney's group that were in that with the energy, the nuclear plant construction.
Public Citizen was founded on being anti-nuclear. We are the leaders of the United States fighting against nuclear power. I never mentioned that once. What I've been talking about is solar power. There is nothing corporate about solar power. There's nothing corporate about empowering America's households to make their own energy in a cost-effective way from the roofs of their home. And I'm sorry, but compressed natural gas is not an infinite bountiful resource. It comes from natural gas, which is a finite fossil fuel that you have to drill to get. And there are dozens of places in the Rocky Mountains that are encountering severe environmental problems. The Washington Post just had a big article about the problems of new natural gas wells in Virginia. Natural gas is not a benign energy source. It is intrusive. You are drilling just like you are drilling for oil. I would not put natural gas in a category of geothermal or solar. It's not renewable.
Let me say this to you, George, and then I promise you I'll give you one more word. But, the group with which Tyson Slocum's affiliated, Public Citizen, has been doing consumer protection for decades now. You may have genuine disagreements on geothermal or compressed natural gas, but I think it's a bit extreme to say that he's lying or a spy like Fox News. I've had Republicans on this show. You know, George, I've had people on here who express strong views in favor of Cheney and Bush. I don't think you'll find Mr. Slocum as one of them. But I'll give you the last word.
All I can say, you haven't convinced me.
Okay, well, that's fair. Right. I just hope we can agree to disagree without calling each other liars. That's all I'm asking. But, George, I value your input, and I always appreciate when you call in the Inside Scoop.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. One last issue, and we only got a few minutes left. But I want to go back to where we started this thing with the markets, because it's very surprising to me how the markets aren't working. I understand what happened in 2001 with Enron in California. Mm-hmm. They controlled really the entire market. There's the famous quote of the guy caught burn, baby, burn when he wanted a fire because he could raise a spike in gas prices. But okay, it's unregulated. All right, I get that. But it's still a market. There are still, I don't know how many players, you can tell me, I assume at least 10 or 20, if not hundreds. How can they fix prices, even unregulated, in a market situation?
Because they have every incentive to do so. And
who are they? Let's be specific.
They are large financial players, such as hedge funds and investment banks, and then the traditional players like oil companies, particularly BP and Shell. And you'll learn this in business school, that it is a tendency when you get very big and you preside over a market, that the tendency is to collude rather than compete. Because true competition can be very uncertain and very painful. And companies want to avoid pain as much as they can. And collusion is a far more attractive thing, especially if everybody around you is making a lot of money. And that's what we're seeing in these energy
classic
markets.
Classic economic theory says that if everyone's setting the price at $4 a gallon, and I set my price at $3.90 a gallon, I'll get all the business and I'll make more money than selling at $4 a gallon. Where does classical economic theory fail in this example?
Because we don't have an adequately competitive market, because we have no rules that are structuring the market.
So in other words, I don't need to lower it to 390 because I can make as much profit as I possibly want at 4.
Exactly. Just
I don't need to make more profit. ExxonMobil's making more than any other corporation on Earth. It doesn't need a couple billion more. It would rather just sit fat and happy, I guess.
Exactly. We saw in California where a company like Enron charged prices that were 1,000% higher overnight, because they were desperate, because they were going bankrupt, because all the other facets of their company weren't working. These other companies understand that you can't blow a fuse that quickly, that if you jack up prices extremely quickly, the clamp is going to come down.
So we only have a little bit of time left. I got to ask you some just real quick questions.
Sure.
We didn't address strategic petroleum reserve. Should we release fuel from it?
I don't know if we should release fuel, but we should stop filling it.
We're still filling it at these prices.
We're still filling it, and that's taxpayer dollars.
Crazy. Okay, you think the Obama solution is the best solution, but at the end of the day, we need more corporate regulation, more regulation of these markets, and more solar energy. Did I get it all?
Absolutely.
And I assume more conservation as well. Thank you, Tyson. You're always a terrific guest. Hopefully, I won't have to have you every May of every future year. Hopefully, we'll resolve some of these issues. I hope you enjoyed the show and enjoyed our new live web broadcast. This is Mark Levine of the Inside Scoop.